Hi, everyone. I'm Jan. I am an alcoholic. And I will tell you about the person that 12-stepped me drunk. It was my sister, actually. That's later on in my story. But what an honor and a privilege to be here. And many of you people out there know Buck and Virginia Melton. And before we came, they told us what a wonderful place this was and how much we were going to love it here. And I can honestly say that I've been emotional all day, and I don't know why that is, but I surely have felt the love of Alcoholics Anonymous here at Monteagle, and I just arrived last night, and I'd like to thank the board and the trustees for inviting me here to spend this weekend with you. I think about what an honor it is to be asked to be of service anywhere in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was thinking about that today. You know, if I can just give a little bit back of what was so freely given to me, then I'm just doing what I was told to do, the way I was grew up. I'm here tonight to share with you in a general way what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like today. And I'm going to try to do that as honestly as I can and to the best of my ability. I am the youngest of five children. I have three older sisters and one older brother, the brother being the oldest. I don't have a whole lot of memories of my childhood. I have blocked those out, and I don't try to go back and unblock them. I feel like if God wants me to know it, He will reveal it to me. That's the first thing my sponsor told me was, God will reveal to you more and more as you need to know it. And if you don't need to know it, He won't reveal it. So. And I stand up here before you tonight, and I take full responsibility for my own recovery, for my life today, and I couldn't do that when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. I blamed everybody and everything for my problems and for the way my life was. I was very angry. I was full of resentment, full of fear, full of dishonesty when I got here, and one of the first things that I heard was, you know, if you become teachable, you can get sober. And the other thing is that you're responsible for your own recovery. And that was new to me because I never wanted responsibility. Because I like being the victim. Because as long as I was a victim, I didn't have to have responsibility. And today I no longer like to play that role, and I have to take responsibility for my life. And the only story that I have to share is my story. I have sisters who have, and my other family members, I'm sure they experienced our life in a different way. I know my oldest sister did, because she remembers things I don't remember. So I can only share with you my experience with that. Like I said, I am the youngest, and I don't have a whole lot of memories. I was raised by my grandmother and grandfather from the time that I remember up until I was about 7 or 8 years old. And I'm going to tell you, I was the baby. So being the baby, I got all the attention and I got all, you know, I got it all. And I loved it. I love being the center of attention. That's part of my personality. I've loved that all my life. And I love getting what I wanted. And it didn't matter what I did. I could do no wrong in my grandmother and grandfather's eyes. And I loved them dearly. I loved them dearly. But I like being the baby, and I like getting my way. And I can honestly say that I don't ever remember telling the truth, so I guess I was lying from the day I was born. You know, I think I was born that way, because to me, lying always seemed better than telling the truth. And I lied for several reasons, because I lied, one, because it got me what I wanted. It got me what I wanted, and two, because it got me out of trouble. I lied for several reasons, and lying not just sounded better. I think I was talking to somebody about that today. We talked about how we could just make things up the way we wanted them to be, excuse me. And that's what I did my whole life. But growing up with grandmother and grandfather, life was good. My life was good with grandmother and grandfather, and I felt loved, and I knew that the world was good, and grandmother taught me about the God of her understanding, and I can remember we'd get on our knees at night and go to bed, and we'd say the Lord's Prayer, And we'd crawl up in that bed, and I'd up under three or four quilts, and that was the safest, warmest place, and I loved being there with her. And I enjoyed. I knew that God was good, I knew that life was good, and that everything was okay. That my father left, that I don't remember my father ever being a part of my life. He left when I was very, very young. And all my life I fantasized about my father, and I placed him up on this pedestal because he was never a part of my life. And so I fantasized about him, and I told everybody what an important man he was, and that he was over in South America. He traveled a lot, and he was rich, and he had all this stuff, and he was just an important man. And I did that for several reasons. I did it because that was the only way that I could live with him not being in my life. That was the only way that I could live with knowing that he just left. And because it was too painful to just realize that he left on his own choice and chose not to have us in his life, I just fantasized and made it okay. And to me, that's the way I survived it. But I always wondered where I got South America from. And because, you know, that's a pretty long way off. And as a child, I didn't know anything about South America. So I thought, where did that come from? I know today, my sister and, excuse me, they've told me that actually when he did leave, they set us all down in the living room. They set us children down in the living room and said that he was going to South America to build a bridge. He just never came back from building that bridge. So I just assumed that he was still in South America. And that was the way I lived with that abandonment and that rejection, because that's what it was, really. But I couldn't identify that for a long time. And around the age of 7 or 8, grandfather had been very ill for a long time, and he died. And I don't remember anything about his death, except I thought it was real cool that I got to ride in that long black Cadillac, because I'd never rode in a car like that before. We didn't have that. We were very poor. And so it was exciting to ride in that long black Cadillac, and I liked that. But I didn't have any, I don't remember feeling bad that he died or anything like that. But what I do remember is that grandmother, after that, got really sick and had to move in with Aunt Esther, and she was my mother's aunt. my mother's sister, and I was moved back in with my mother. And my mother is an alcoholic by her own admission. I'm not here to tell her story, but she's admitted that, and she's even tried Alcoholics Anonymous. And what she said was that she would come to the meetings and hear those sad stories, and she'd just have to go drink for them, and she just... And she believed that, and I let her believe it. It's not my place to tell her. But I've never known my mother to be sober. She's not drinking today. She's not in a program of recovery either. And she's sick a lot. But growing up, I never knew my mother to be sober. I never saw my mother sober. Now, my oldest sister knew a sober mother. She knew a mother that would sit her on her knee and sing to her and take some interest in her. By the time I got moved back home, mother was in full-blown alcoholism. And what I know about alcoholism today, because of my disease, that it, with for the alcoholic, for me, alcohol was the most important thing in my life. And my family, anything else came second. So I understand that today. I did not understand it back then, and I resented it. And I was, you know, my life went from being stable and being consistent to total chaos. When I moved back in with mother's, with mother, you know, I hear a lot of people say they grew up in an alcoholic family, you know, in an alcoholic home. We had alcoholic neighborhoods. We grew up in drunk trailer parks, and I know that some of y'all know what those are, okay? Poor drunk neighborhoods, and all our neighbors were drunks, so we fit right in there. And I resented being poor. I resented being poor, and and we didn't have a lot of material things. We were on welfare, and we may or may not have clean clothes to wear. We may or may not have had food in the refrigerator. There was a lot of times when we didn't have food to eat. And my oldest sister, the one who 12-stepped me drunk, became the mother to me and my sibling. My brother, at an early age, was in and out of trouble with the law, in and out of Jackson Training Schools, and going about his disease. He suffers from the same disease. But Kay became the mother, and to dress us, she would go steal our clothes. And Libby is only 3 years older than me, and she would dress us like twins. And what I figured was that it was just easier to steal two sets of clothes off the same rack than try to steal two separate sets of clothes, you know. It was just easier that way. And we look a lot alike, so a lot of people thought we were twins. But that's how we clothed ourselves, because it was up to us to clothe ourselves. It was up to us to feed ourselves. And I can remember that when Mama would come in, and I tell you these things because of how I internalized these, you know, she would come in at night, and she would wake us up about 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, and we'd have to put her to bed, and we became the mother to her, really. You know, we had to grow up real fast. We became her mother, and we'd put her to bed, and we'd get her some coffee, and we'd have to sit there and wait on her, and this is just the way it was. And she'd lay there, and she'd say, "I'm going to die. I'm just going to die." Now, at 7 or 8, 8 and a half years old, I didn't know that she meant she was going to pass out. Now, she knew she meant she was going to pass out. I literally thought she meant she was going to die. And I'd already lost my grandmother and that. And I would cry and I would beg her and I'd say, "Mama, please don't die. Don't leave me," you know. And that set a fear of abandonment in me. Because all the time I was just wondering, well, is it going to be today? Is she going to die today? And she always wore wigs. It was back in the 60s, and she had these mini skirts and the wigs, you know, and some of that stuff's coming back in style, I know. But we used to watch American Bandstand. And back then, American Bandstand had the Go-Go Girls on there, you know, and they had the white boots and the short skirts. And Mother had this long blonde wig that I loved to play with, you know, and I'd get up on that coffee table and I'd put on that long wig and I'd pretend I was one of those go-go girls. I'd watch American Bandstand and dance with them. Well, one night she came in and it was the same routine and she said, "I'm going to die." Well, I started freezing my feelings. See, I started not trusting because crazy stuff went on in our house, you know, and we never knew what was going to happen in our house and we never knew we just didn't know it was crazy, but I quit feeling. I quit caring at a very early age. And so this time, instead of crying and begging her not to die, I just looked up at her and said, "Mama, can I have your wig?" You know, because I quit caring whether she died or not. I wanted the wig. That was more important to me than whether she lived or died, because I resented her that much. I was confused. I was full of fear. I was full of anger and didn't know how to tell anybody. And that's how we lived. Now, if we wanted Christmas, we spent Christmases in places called the Blue Barrel and the Red Barn and Bootleggers. That's where our family, that's where we were raised, because that's where my mother was. And around the age of 8 or 9 years old, my mother went in to a blackout. And I don't know how long she was in a blackout, but what happened was that by this time, Kay, who had been the mother to us, got married at the age of 14 because she knew that was better than being in the home. So she got married at the age of 14 and became a mother to somebody else. Really, you know, we just keep doing what we know to do. Like I said, my brother was in and out of Jackson Training School, in and out of prison, jails at that time. And my middle sister, Phyllis, I don't know where she was. I don't remember her being in our life at all. She was just, I don't know, she was pushed. As she says now, that what happened was when Mother went into that blackout, she ended up giving me and Libby to a woman on Cramerton Mountain, which is in Gaston County. because she knew she couldn't take care of us. The problem was when she came out of that blackout, she couldn't remember who she gave us to or where we were. And so she showed up at my Aunt Esther's house and said, I can't find Libby and Jan. And so the Department of Social Services had to be called in. And when that happened, of course, they found us. And we got placed into their custody. And we got placed in Junior Order Children's Home in Lexington, North Carolina, which is an orphanage. I got placed in the nursery. My sister got placed in the dormitory above me, and my mother got placed in Broughton. And that fear of abandonment, that rejection that I felt, I was so angry and so confused, and I didn't know why it all happened. I thought it was all my fault. I internalized it as being me. Also, during this time, as far back as I can remember, up until I stopped it, I had one aunt and uncle that took an interest in us. And to me, they were rich because they had a home and they had food in the refrigerator and they had clothes. You know, they had, and my two cousins had toys to play with. And they would come and let us stay at their house and they would let us share in those things with them. But my uncle was also sexually abusing me every night that I was there. And I tell you that for one reason and one reason only, it's because how I internalized it. I internalized the shame and the guilt, and I thought that I caused it. And I thought that if I was just different or if I was better, then none of this stuff would have happened. And that's how I looked at my life. I thought so I was sick way before I took a drink of alcohol. I truly believe that alcohol was only a symptom of my disease and that I was affected. I've been affected by this disease both by me being the alcoholic and by alcoholism in my family. And so I was sick way before I ever took a drink of alcohol. And I truly believe that alcohol restored my sanity, kept me sane for just a little while. But anyway, so I had all this stuff going on in me. And so when social services came into our life, that was my biggest resentment ever. Because even though our life was crazy and it was chaotic, I was still able to do what I wanted to do. I was still able to go where I wanted to go and do what I wanted to do because I didn't have anybody looking after me and telling me what to do. And I liked that. I liked being able to do what I wanted to do. And so when I had somebody all of a sudden who was in my life saying, you have to live here and you have to do this, I resented that. And I thought, who are you to come in here and tell me what to do? And how dare you take me away from my family? And actually, that saved my life. And I know that today. But they were just the easiest ones to be angry at because I couldn't be angry at the people that I was supposed to love. And so I was angry at them. And I got placed in this home, and I resented being there. And all of a sudden, I wasn't the baby anymore, and I wasn't getting all the attention. And I was in a home with about 100 or so other children. And the house parents had their hands full because they was all sick like me. I mean, we all came from the same sort of scenario. So, you know, that's tough, I'm sure, because I was pretty tough, just being me. And they had about 100 others like me, and that's bad. But I learned real early on that the good kids didn't get the attention. And like I said, I like attention, and I had always liked it. And I felt all I ever wanted was somebody to say, hey, Jan, you're important. Because I didn't feel important. I was very lonely, and I felt like what I thought, what I said, what I wanted didn't matter. It was what they wanted for me. And so I wanted some attention, and I always wanted to be loved because I always felt unloved. Now, I knew grandmother and grandfather loved me, but I always felt unloved and unwanted and different my whole life. I felt that way. And I learned early on that it didn't matter whether it was negative or positive attention as long as somebody was noticing me, as long as they knew that I was around. So I learned real early that I didn't want to be good because the good kids didn't get the attention. And so I hung out with the kids that got the attention. And there was some bad things that happened in this home, but all I did was I never fought back, I stuffed it. See, I'm a good stuffer, and I stuffed all this stuff down in here because, I didn't know how to talk about it. And nobody ever really asked me, Jan, are you, I don't ever remember anyone asking me about these things, so I didn't know how to talk about it, so I acted out. a lot. And I had gotten into borrowing things. And what that really means is that I'm a good con. And if I could con you out of something and let you think that I needed it worse than you and you let me borrow it, then you didn't need it back. See, because what you had was always better than what I had. Mine was never good enough, and that's how I felt. So I would borrow things. That's stealing. You know, I know that today. That's because I did it with no intentions of ever repaying it back or ever giving it back. But I know today what the big book talks about says when we make decisions based on self, which later place us in a position to be hurt. I had done that all my life, and there were good people. See, I'm not going to sit here and tell you I did that drinking, you know, there were no good people in my life and this place didn't help me, but that's not true. There were good people in my life. They were people who tried to love me. The problem was I wouldn't let them. And the reason I wouldn't let them is because I didn't trust it to last. I thought if it, you know, you're not going to be here and you're just doing this because you feel sorry for me. And so I'm going to take what I can get from you and be on about my way. And say, I learned that real early. And good people offered me their home and they welcomed me into their home. And I would steal from them and I would lie to them and I would act out in their home. And of course, I never got asked back, which again just doubled that rejection. But see, I created that. And I didn't know that I created that for a long time. But I created that based on my behavior and the fact that I couldn't allow good things into my life because I didn't trust them. And so eventually what happened in that home was Libby graduated from high school and I started running away because then I was really alone. At least for a while there, I still had my sister. And but I couldn't stand being there without her, and I just had taken all that I could take in that home, and I started running away. And I didn't, and I started fighting back. I started rebelling really, really bad, and I'd fight the house parents, and I'd fight anybody that, you know, I just started acting out. Also, so I started running away to my social worker and kept telling her, if you don't move me, I'm going to run away again. And she... Eventually, I guess after fourth, fifth time that I ran away, she said, Jan, if I promise to have you out of there by the time school starts, will you please go back and stay? I said, well, I guess I can do that because school started like in 2 weeks, so I thought I can handle it for 2 weeks. And just before that, I need to back up and tell you about Mom and Dad Knapp, and they are my foster parents who live in Lexington, North Carolina. And see, because for the first time, this couple, it was on Thanksgiving, and their church had come out to the campus, and they had brought the children, you know, baskets and that type of stuff. And they had asked the house parent, does all the children have a place to stay? And they go for Thanksgiving. And they tell me this, and they've told Tim this same story. And I don't remember this. They said, all but one little girl, and she's upstairs crying. And Mom met me, and she went to her community, and she got letters from her pastor, from her neighbors, and they came and got me that Thanksgiving. And they've been in my life ever since. Now, those are the second set of people in my life who love me unconditionally, who knew, and that's what they told me today, and they still tell me that, is that we knew you had problems when we invited you into our home. Because I did the same thing to them that I did to everybody else. I lied to them and I acted out and I stole and I did those things but they asked me back and I didn't understand that and they loved me unconditionally, and I think it's through the love of their God that they were able to do that because they taught me about their God, not so much by preaching to me but by how they lived and by sharing their spirituality with me, and that has stuck with me. That's how I knew that God was good, through these people. And I know that it was their love. It was the little bit of love and the little bit of goodness that came, that I allowed to come into my life that saved me. And I know that today. But anyway, I did run away. And I eventually got moved the beginning sophomore year of my high school. I got moved to Banner Elk, North Carolina, to Grandfather Mountain Children's Home. And by this time, I'm about 15, I guess. And I've got walls so thick around me, nobody can get through them. And I've been, you know, full of self-will, selfishness and self-centeredness, full of self-pity, full of anger, full of all this stuff. And these people at Grandfather Mountain Children's Home tried to teach me responsibility and teach me life skills, and they were good to me, and I loved it there. For the first time, I really loved being where I was. But I didn't trust them either. So because I didn't trust them, I wouldn't let them help me. And I thought, well, I've been doing okay by myself all these years. I don't need y'all to tell me what to do. And again, it was my idea that they were trying to tell me what to do. You know, I am rebellious, and I don't like authority. I'm defiant by nature. I think that's part of the alcoholic personality. And so, God forbid, plus I'm 15 years old, which goes just by itself, you know. Adolescence, I think, has a lot to do with that, too. But they tried to teach me, and again, I was unteachable. I would not allow them to teach me. I didn't want to listen. And they gave me campus jobs and wanted to start me up a savings account and pay me like a regular salary so that I would have money saved up for when I graduated high school or college. I had the chance to go to any college that I wanted to go to. I had a lot of good opportunities. And while I was there, I had the opportunity to go to the North Carolina School of the Arts in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, because I was very good in drama. I love drama. And that's only because I'm an actor, see? I'm an actor. And I can wear a mask, and I can be whoever you want me to be. And I have done that all my life. So that was just a natural thing for me to do. But I loved it. And so I had a lot of good opportunities that I chose not to act on. Around 15 or 16 years old, well, I guess I was getting ready to be 16. My social worker called me into his office, and he says, well, we're going to reunite you with your family. Now, it had been a long time since I had seen my family. And, of course, I fantasized. I love fantasies. You know, the big book says that we alcoholics can't differentiate the truth from the false. And it's talking about our alcoholic world because we think that's the only normal one. And I really thought that nobody else, I really thought my alcoholic world was normal because everybody I knew lived that way. But anyway, I'd fantasized about how it was going to be when I finally got home. And we were going to live in this white house and the green yard and the white picket fence, and we were going to be the Cleaver family. And when I come home, they were going to roll the red carpet out for me because, you know, they miss me. I'd been gone a long time. That egomania, and it was, so he says, how do you feel about that? And I thought, well, this is great. This is what I've always wanted, and I knew it was just going to work out perfectly. Well, you know, without recovery of some, there's no recovery. Without recovery, nothing changes. It only gets worse. Well, they put me on a Trailways bus, and I rode the Trailways bus from Banner Elk to Charlotte. And what I came home to was a mother that was still drunk running a bootleggers in Gaston County, a brother that was still in prison, maybe had gotten out once or twice in between that time, but I always went back, and three sisters that were drunk across the river. Now, when I say across the river, it's because Gaston County was dry at that time, and we had to cross the bridge into Mecklenburg County to get to bars, and that's across the river to us. And across the river was not, where we went was not very nice places. And, of course, I wasn't a very nice person when I drank, so that's all right. So when I started coming home, I would go to these places. This is where I would go. I would go to the bootleggers, or I would stay across the river, and I resented it. I resented them being drunk. I resented, and I was hurt. I said, didn't y'all miss me? You know, that selfishness and self-centeredness and that's full of self-pity. And I never once thought about their pain, and I never once thought about what they were going through. I couldn't see beyond my own nose. And I said, y'all don't love me. If you love me, you wouldn't do this. But it had nothing to do with me. They were doing the only thing they knew to do, and I know that today. I didn't know that back then. So, of course, they didn't roll the red carpet out, and I got mad about that. And I swore I'd never be like them. I said, I won't be like you. I'll be different. That's what I said when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm different. And I thought I was. I had terminal uniqueness when I got here because nobody had known where I'd been or done what I, you know, felt what I felt or and all those things that we think when we get here or that I thought. But anyway, it didn't take me long to realize that, and I didn't drink for a couple of times, a couple of visits home, and they'd set me in the corner, and I'd be good. But we frequented this one bar across the river, which is called the Red Baron, and they had a pool room back there, and I noticed that there was this little cute fella that played pool in that pool room, and he was there every weekend that I was there. Now, I didn't know how to date. I didn't know how to talk to the opposite sex. I had never done that. I was not socially skilled at all, to be quite honest. But I thought, well, I'll just mosey back here in this pool room because he'll notice me if I go back there, you know. And I guess I just stood up against the wall like kids do and be cool and all that stuff. And he did notice me, and he asked me if I wanted to shoot a game of pool. I said, sure I do. And, of course, now I had to make it sound bigger and better and be bigger and better than it was. And he says, well, how old are you? I said, oh, I'm 19 years old. I think I was 16, maybe. 16 and a half, and he says, where are you from? And I said, oh, I go to Lees McRae College in Banner Elk, North Carolina. I'm just down here visiting, you know. And he says, well, isn't so-and-so your sister? And I said, sure, but do not compare me to her, because I'm different. I'm different. The lies, I mean, and the lies just were so naturally that came out of my mouth. I believed them myself, and I thought, you know, because it sounded so good. And I thought, well, if I have to believe them to get you to believe them, so I believe my own lies. But he says, you want a beer? And I said, sure I do. And I'd never drank up to this point and then really didn't know what it could do for me. Because the book says that we alcoholics drink for the effect produced by alcohol. Well, I'm going to tell you the effect that I had that night. He came and he racked those bottles and he went and got this cold frosted mug of draft beer, and he brought that out there, and I had to pretend like I knew what I was doing, so I drank that thing down right fast, and I'm going to tell you, the magic happened, and I had lived with this black hole in my gut for years, and I think it was spiritual sickness, it was loneliness, it was just pain, and I know that's what it was, and I'm going to tell you, when I drank that alcohol, that little black hole that was in my gut, it just sort of closed right on up, and there was no black hole there anymore. And I felt pretty, and I felt smart, and the neon lights was going, and the jukebox was going, and I could dance, and I had this good-looking guy shooting a game of pool with me. And I'm thinking, I can remember thinking, this is it. It was a conscious thought. This is it. This is what life is all about. Look what I've been missing. And at that moment, alcohol became the most important thing to me in my life. I never was a social drinker. I was an alcoholic from the time I was just an alcoholic waiting on a drink, really what it was. I think I was genetically inclined to have this disease. And I'm going to tell you, after that, I thought, I'm going to get alcohol any way that I can. It became the most, because I never felt normal in my whole life. And I felt that ease and comfort that Dr. Silk, I think that's Dr. Silkworth that talks in the doctor's opinion that we feel irritable, restless, and discontent unless we can feel the comfort and the ease that comes with taking that drink. And that's what it did for me. It comforted me, and it put me at ease. And it made my world okay. And it made me okay for the first time in my life. So after that, I would get on the Trailways bus, and I would come home, and I would not see my family because I started seeing this little fella, and he'd pick me up on Fridays instead of my family, and I'd be gone with him the whole weekend. I wouldn't see my family because I didn't want anything to do with them anyway. And I, you know, I'm not proud of that, but that's just the way I felt. And that became my normal routine. Well, eventually, I didn't want to keep going riding that Trailways bus. I didn't want to be up there in Banner Elk anymore. I didn't want to be in school. I didn't want to be doing. I wanted to be down here drinking. So the last weekend, it was one weekend in the summer, and I took my weekend clothes, shorts, you know, just stuff for the weekend. And prior to that, I had been offered a job at Tweetsie Railroad, and they kept telling me things at this home, like, Jan, you're not responsible enough to handle this job. because I showed no responsibility. I didn't want responsibility. I wanted to do what I wanted to do right then. I never thought about the consequences of my behavior because that wasn't important. It was that self-gratification that I wanted, that instant gratification. And however I got that was okay with me. So when they told me that I couldn't take that off-campus job because I wasn't responsible enough, which was the truth, I thought, I'll show you. Next time I go home, I just won't come back. And I've done that my whole life. I'll show you, I'll kill me. You know, I didn't think about where am I going to live, how am I going to live, because I certainly wasn't listening to what they were telling me. The fact of the matter was that I knew I could drink if I got home. That's why I ran away that last time. I wanted to drink more and I wanted to be up there. And so I became a bum at 16 and a half, 17 years old. Because I wasn't going to live. When I went home that weekend, I knew that I wanted to drink. But I couldn't stay with my family because I was ashamed of them, you know, and I was different from them, and I wasn't going to be like them, and I was angry at them. So I became a bum because I had a good, sad story, and I had all these people in the bars that I could con a drink out of, or I could con them for a place to stay for a day, you know, for a week or two till they wanted stuff like rent money or grocery money or wanted me to maybe get a job and help out. And I thought, no, I can't do that. That would interfere with my plans. So, you know, I'd go on to the next person who became my victim. That's what I became a good con, and I could tell this sad story, and I could cry, and I could, you know, manipulate people. Because that's what we alcoholics do. We manipulate our way to get what we want, or that's what this alcoholic did. I don't know that. That's what I did. I manipulated and I used people, and I didn't think about how they felt or how it affected them. And eventually, though, when you have done that, and Belmont's a small town, and across that rivers are small bars. You know, you use up everybody real quick, or the word gets around that that's what you do. And pretty soon, I'd used up all the people I could use up, and I always was hanging out. I hung out with these older people. Of course, that's every alcoholic that I've ever heard speak. That's what we do. We hang out with older people because they can get our liquor for us. I could go in the liquor store and I learned the cashiers by first name. And so that next time I didn't need to go in with them, I could go in, they wouldn't card me, and I could buy my own liquor. And I wasn't yet 21 years old. I sure wasn't old enough to even be in the bars, much less be buying my own liquor. But my disease and my tolerance progressed real fast, and I could drink a half gallon or a fifth a night easy and not get drunk because my tolerance was up. Now, when I finally hit my bottom, I could drink one beer and be in a blackout because my tolerance flip-flopped. But in the beginning, alcohol worked for me, and alcohol was fun, and I was having a good time with it because it made me feel what I'd never felt before, and I was enjoying it. And the people that I hung out with happened to run some bars up on Wilkinson Boulevard, and like I said, I knew that I was going to have to do something because I done used up everybody that I could use up, and I knew that I was going to get alcohol any way that I could get alcohol, that I did not ever want to draw sober breath. I really didn't, because being drunk was the only time I felt normal and the only time I felt okay, so I was not going to be, I didn't want to be sober. And so these people who happened to run these bars on Wilkinson Boulevard always needed young women to work for them, and they were always eager to have new young women work for them, and they offered me a job, and I said yes. And I said yes because it was a way for me to stay drunk. And if you're a female alcoholic like I am, you're going to do whatever it takes to get alcohol. And that's what I did. And now I had morals and I had values, and I'd been taught right from wrong, and I knew about God, and I knew that God was good, and I love God. And my intentions growing up was not to be out there on those streets in those bars drinking the way that I was. But any good thoughts that I had and any morals that I had, and I had good intentions, I wanted to be a good person. I really did. Alcohol was more important to me. The good intentions, the good thoughts, they were all stuffed down in my big toe, because out there in those streets and in those bars, you can't have those and live with yourself very long. You can't do it. So I hardened myself a little bit more and hardened my heart and used people and abused people and just lived that life. And I can remember hating myself, thinking, why am I? I didn't want to be there, didn't want to do those things, but that was the only thing that I could do and continue to drink. And so I lived it, and I didn't draw a sober breath. I drank every single day. I was either in the bar working, and I was not going to work sober. So I had to be drunk to work. And if I worked the day shift, then I was, at night, I was either at another bar or at an all-night bootlegger joint or at an all-night poker. I mean, you know, just wherever. That was my life. And it worked because I had no responsibility, which I didn't want anyway, and it was still working for me. But I always wanted a home of my own, and I always wanted it to be different. My whole life, the only thing I ever wanted was to be adopted. Some people, and I think about that, and I thought, how sad for somebody, you know, I didn't want to be a doctor, I just wanted to be adopted. I wanted a home of my own, and I wanted somebody to love me, and I wanted to be normal, and that was all I ever wanted. And so during this time, I met the man that I'm married to today. And Tim, I'd like to introduce y'all to my husband, Tim. Would you please stand up? This is my husband, Tim. And we've been married for 12 years. Been together, I guess, about 15. But I was still working in these bars and stuff when I met him in a regular bar. That's what I call it. Because I'd go to those regular bars to hear the band and to dance with my clothes on, really, if you want to know the truth. So nobody know what I did out there. So I met him, and I'd only meet him on Friday nights because he, during the week, he did things like work and he held a job down, and he was able to have a home and all the things that I'd ever wanted in my life. He had what I wanted. And so I'd meet him on Friday nights. I wouldn't tell him what I was doing. Now, by this time, I'm blacking out quite a bit. I'm blacking out. So I've talked to this man in blackouts. I've talked to several. I don't know what I've said to him. So I can't stand up here and say that I never told him what I was doing. I don't know that. I don't consciously remember telling him what I was doing during the week. But I would meet him on Friday nights, and we may have stayed at that bar, but most of the time we'd just go to his home and we'd watch TV. We'd drink because I'd black out on the couch watching TV. But what happened eventually was that he asked me to move in with him, and for the first time now I thought I've got a chance. See, and I was scared of him. He tells me I was scared of him when I first met him, and I guess I was because he. He looked mean when I first met him. He's not, you know, but he looked that way. But I got to know him, and he's the most gentle man that I know. But anyway, he asked me to move in with him, and I thought, wow, this is my chance. Okay, up to this point, I'd not tried to quit, not have ever tried to quit, didn't have any reason to quit, and didn't want to quit. Now I want to stop drinking. I want to get my life together because I've got a chance. And for the first time, I've tried, and I can't. And I thought, when he asked me to move in with him, I thought, sure. This will sober me up. This is what I've always wanted. So, you know, this is going to be the end of this part of me. And that lasted about a week. Because the binging started after that. Because he works third shift. Now, and one night I just decided, well, he left for work about 11:30 that night, and I thought, it's Friday night, I can go to the bar and have one beer and tell these people how good I'm doing, and I could be home, you know, before he gets home in the morning from work. And that was okay. I did that the first couple times. And I made it home like at 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning before he got home from work. But I guess he always wondered why I couldn't get out of bed to 1 or 2 o'clock in the afternoon, you know. It's because I'd been out all night long. He didn't know that. But eventually it got to the point where I couldn't come home the same night I left. And I didn't understand that. That really confused me. Why I couldn't come home the same day I left. I thought that, you know, and I can remember binging, and I can remember coming off a 3 or 4 day drunk and being suicidal. You know, we get very remorseful and very Oh man, you know, I'm ready to die after three or four coming. And I went to this psychiatrist's office, and she said, "Well, how much do you drink?" And I said, "Oh, not much." Not, that has nothing to do with it. I said, "My problem is that I can't come home the same day that I leave." And I don't know why that is. And I really thought that was my problem. I had no idea that alcohol had anything to do with it. I was sick now. And it got worse. There were times, and you know, I'd be sitting at a bar, and I'm the alcoholic the big book describes in here. I'm sitting at that bar, and I take that first drink, you know, and if you're an alcoholic, once you take that first drink, when I take that first drink, I'm totally out of control. The obsession begins in my mind because I'm either thinking about drinking, thinking about getting over a drunk, or thinking about how I'm going to get my next drunk. I mean, whatever. The obsession kicks in, but the craving don't start until I take that first drink. So once I take that first drink into my body, the craving develops, and I can't stop. And I'm totally out of control. I'm powerless over alcohol. And once I take any alcohol whatsoever into my body, I can't tell you where I'm going to be, who I'm going to be with, what state I'll end up in, or anything else, because I don't know. And I'm sitting at this bar, and I'm thinking, well, maybe I'll just have one more. You know, I'm looking at my watch, and it's only 10:30, you know. And I'm thinking, I can have one more. And then I think, well, maybe I need to call home. I think, well, I have one more before I call home, so I have that one more. And then I think, well, heck, I might as well not call home. I'm already in trouble, you know, that thought process that we go through. And then I think, well, heck, I might as well blow it out now, you know, so I wouldn't call home. And so it'd be just that cycle. And when I eventually would come home, you know, Tim never said a word. Tears would be streaming down his face, and I would beg him to forgive me. And I would ask him, please let me come home one more time. And if love could have got me sober, I would have gotten sober, because I know he loved me. But his love couldn't keep me sober, and the home couldn't keep me sober, and none of that stuff could have kept me sober. If love could have got me sober, I'd have been sober. But tears, and he would always let me come back home. And the big book says that when we're sitting at that bar and we're thinking about that thought process, and then I think about, well, what's the use anyhow? I'm already in trouble. By the time I get there, I'm way beyond human aid. I am beyond human aid. And eventually what happened, though, was Tim kicked me out. Because I'd lied about all I could lie. And I can remember I remember calling him home from work one night, begging him to help me and asking him, what is wrong with me? Why can't I stop doing what I'm doing? Because I don't want to be doing what I'm doing. And I'd take my fist and I'd just beat myself in the face. I'd stand in front of that mirror and I'd beat myself in the face. And I called myself all kind of degrading names because I didn't want to be what I was. I hated me. I hated the life that I was living. I hated how I felt on the inside. And when he kicked me out, that was my bottom. Because before that, I knew that I always had a place to go to. I always had somebody that was going to take up for me and do for me. And when he said no more, I knew he meant no more. And what happened was I ended up at my sister's house, and she was drunk when I showed up at her house. But her father-in-law had been sober now for a couple months in AA. So he'd been preaching AA to her. So when I showed up at her house, she says, I know where you need to be. Now, she didn't think she needed to be here. She's got 9 years in this program now. But at that time, she didn't think she needed to be here. She took me to detox. She knew exactly what I needed. And thank God she did. Again, I believe that was God doing for me what I couldn't do for myself. So I ended up in Gaston County Detox. And first I said, well, I'm not going there. It's for drunks. I forgot that's what I was. And for the first time when I was in detox, they said, Jan, you're an alcoholic. Now, up to this point, I thought I was crazy. Up to this point, I didn't know what was wrong with me. I thought, man, just put me in Broughton and lock the key up. I thought I was going to be just like my mother. And when they said, Jan, you're an alcoholic, You have a disease called alcoholism. It's a sickness, and you're not responsible for your disease. You are responsible for your behavior, but you can't help you're an alcoholic. Man, I'm telling you, the weight of the world just lifted off my shoulders because I thought, now I can do something about it. I didn't know what to do about it before. That was the biggest relief to me, was to find out that I was sick, that I wasn't an ugly, dirty person, that I was a sick human being, and that with recovery, I could get better. The second biggest relief was they said, Jan, you have to get honest. Now, I didn't know a thing about honesty when I got here, nothing. But for the first time, I didn't have to lie to you about who I was. I didn't have to pretend to be better than I was. I didn't have to pretend to be bigger than I was. I was so tired of lying. I was so tired of pretending. I was so tired of just, I was sick of me, but I was so tired of the lies and the deceit. And that was the second biggest relief, was to know I didn't have to lie anymore. And no matter where I'd been or what I'd done, you people loved me anyway. And I didn't understand that unconditional love when I got here. And then the third thing I heard was you have to become teachable, because only the teachable will get sober. And for the first time, I know God was doing for me what I couldn't do for myself. I became willing to listen to somebody else. I became teachable. But now I didn't stay sober that first time in detox. I ended up going there the second two times. Because I tried to find the AA meeting after I got out of detox that time, couldn't find it, and felt sorry for myself, and ended up back across the river. And ended up back up in detox, and spent 8 days there, and from there I went to 28-day treatment in Black Mountain, which is just a state drying-out place, is all it is. And treatment didn't do anything for me other than let me quit shaking after 28 days. That's all it did, and it pointed me to the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I spent my 28 days there, and they said, and first meeting, I got out, and I went to the Shuffletown group, which was two blocks from my home. They said, of course, get a sponsor. So I'm sick now, folks, and I thought, well, if the women here are going to accept me, they have to, you know, they're going to have to sponsor me in order to accept me. I didn't know that you love me just because I'm me. So it was that give and take, that sick thinking that I had to be doing something for you to like me and that kind of stuff. So I had 9 sponsors at one time, because every woman I saw, I asked to be my sponsor. And I also thought, well, if they're sponsoring me, they have to like me. That's not true, because later on, you know, the sponsor I got says, I'm not here to be your friend. I'm here to help you get sober and to live sober. If we're friends, that's a byproduct. But if we ever become such good friends that I can't sponsor you, I won't sponsor you. And I understand that today, but that back then I didn't know that. So every woman I saw, I asked to be my sponsor. I was confused. But first things first, I believe that God intervened in my life the day I said, God, please help me, when I'd hit that very last bottom and I couldn't, and I was willing. God started doing for me, and I knew automatically that nobody else was going to keep me sober, that God was the only person that was going to keep me sober. And nobody had to tell me that. Somehow that was just, that automatically happened. So there hasn't been a day gone by since I've come into Alcoholics Anonymous that I haven't asked God to keep me sober, that I don't get up every morning and I spend time with my God. And I'll talk about my spiritual journey, because this program is spiritual. As I was reading in my big book, and the way Louise always told me is, Jan, the spiritual life is not a theory. We have to live it. To me, living it is putting it to use in my home and on my job and in my community, and not just in meetings, because it's easy for me to put it to use for an hour with you people. It's harder to put it to use out there in the real world. So I knew automatically that this was a God deal. How I knew that, I don't know. Again, I think that was God doing for me what I couldn't do for myself. So I never, from the very beginning, nobody ever said, Jan, ask God to keep you sober. I just innately knew that God was the only thing that was going to keep me sober, because I tried every other means. You know, I went through the psychiatrist, and I went through the religious books, and I even tried having people lock me up in their house. After one of my binges, I said, here, just keep me locked up in here so that I'll be safe. And they had to call Tim and say, she's over here with us. She's all right. But, you know, But of course, I couldn't stay locked up for my whole life. I had to eventually get back out there, and I couldn't live that way. I couldn't live sanely. I just couldn't live without drinking. So I automatically knew. And that first year was grace. See, my whole life has been nothing but grace. I couldn't see it for so long. But my God's been doing for me my entire life what I could not do for myself. From the time that I was born up until today, and He will continue to do so. I know today that He kept me in His arms when I was in those homes. And when those things was happening to me, that's what saved my life. And God knew that. And I also believe today that whatever happened to me, there's a reason for it. And for me, today I see it that it's that maybe I can use it to help somebody else because I've been healed from it. And that's the only thing that I know. So that first year what I learned was don't drink, go to meetings. And I went to a meeting every single night. I surrounded myself with people in Alcoholics Anonymous. I started making coffee. I started doing things, and they had to teach me some things like how to dress when I got here. Because when I got here, I was not a lady by no means. I wanted to be, but I was not. And so they had to teach me how to dress and how to present myself in society and how to not cuss the waitress out when I order food at a restaurant, you know, and those type of things. And so I learned those things. But after the year, I kept hearing people say, and I had sponsors, but at that point, no sponsor had taken me through the big book, nor had they taken me through the steps. I just started doing, I did steps 1, 2, and 3 by my every single day. That's what I did without ever being told that that's what I had to do. I didn't even know that I was doing it, but that's what I was doing. And but I eventually realized I was missing out on a lot. So at my home group at that time was Mount Holly, and Louise R. was a member of that group, and she had 20 years sobriety when she died. But she was about as tall as this podium at about 90 pounds, and fire would fly from her eyes when she talked. And I, you know, and she believed in this program. And she didn't care if she hurt your feelings. She didn't care whether you liked what she said. She was going to tell you what was in this book, and she wouldn't tell you her opinion. She says, this is the program. And I knew that I wanted her for my sponsor, but I was scared of her. I was scared of her. But eventually I went and asked her. I said, Louise, would you please sponsor me? She says, you go home and pray about it, and I will too. And I guess I thought God was going to tell her no, to tell her to say no, because it took me another 6 months to ask her again. But I did. And the second time she says, Jan, you be at my house at 6 o'clock on Wednesday evening. Have your big book and your 12 and 12 with you. And so I showed up, and the first thing she said, Jan, are you willing to go to any lengths to stay sober? Because if you're not willing to go to any lengths to stay sober, I can't help you. But if you are willing to go to any lengths to stay sober, I will go with you. And she says, I won't ever ask you to do what I haven't had to do or what I'm not willing to go with you to do. And that's the truth. She never did. And she says, you have to be honest with me. If you lie to me, I can't help you. And there are certain things that she expects her girls, if she sponsors us, this is what she, and I hear her now in my head. I expect you to act a certain way in meetings. I expect you to dress a certain way in meetings, because this is how sober ladies do it. That's what, and she taught me those things, and it was what I always wanted to be and just didn't know how to be that. And so we started to work on these steps, and now I knew about the first step, and I know about powerlessness. I know that the minute I take any form of alcohol in my body whatsoever, whether it be beer, wine, liquor, whatever, one drink is never enough. That's just enough to get the craving started, and I'm totally out of control. I can't predict to you what will happen once I take that first drink. I am totally powerless over alcohol. I'm powerless over a lot of other things today. The only thing I'm not powerless over is my actions and my attitudes and what I choose to do. That's the only thing I'm not powerless over. But my life was totally unmanageable, and I heard Judy S. talk, and she talks about her drunk hair and her drunk bathrobe. My whole life was drunk. My home was drunk. My car was a drunk car, you know. Everything about me was drunk. I couldn't hold a job because by this time I had tried really to get normal jobs. I still call them normal jobs. That's so odd. But I tried to work. I tried to work at a regular 8-hour job, and I couldn't do it. And I just was unemployable. My life was a total wreck. And so I knew about that, and I didn't have a problem with that. And then the second step talks about coming to believe in a power, you know, that can restore us to sanity. We came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. And I think about that, and I believed that from day one. I believed in God. I've always believed in God. I just thought God had forgotten about me. I really did. I thought, I'm too bad. He don't want anything to do with me. And then I think about that sanity that the second step is talking about, and I don't think it's talking about the insane things that I do drunk. Because alcohol lowers the inhibitions of the person drinking the alcohol. So drunks just normally do stupid things because we're drunk, you know. The insanity is the fact that I would go home and I would beg my husband to take me in, and I would promise him I would never do it again, and I would promise me I would never do it again. And I remember the shame and the humiliation that I put myself through. But see, the big book says 2 days later, we don't remember it. And that was the way it was for me. I couldn't remember the shame or the degradation or the humiliation from a night before. The next day, I was off thinking it'd be different. That's the insanity. The insanity is taking that drink after the promises I made and knowing what it was going to be, thinking it'd be different. The insanity of this disease. So I did come to believe that a power greater than me could restore me to sanity. And some of the things I started early on, I started getting to know this power, because if this power is what's going to save me, I want to know who it is or what it is. Not that I understand him any better, but I do know who he is today. So not only did I do that with my steps, but I studied other books. I went to church. I did those things. I sought out the God of my understanding. And the big book says if we seek him, he will reveal himself to us. If we earnestly seek him, he will reveal himself to us. And he has revealed himself to me. Today I know who he is. But the most important thing is today I know he knows who I am. And that I'm important to him. And that he loves me. And that's so that, you know, I couldn't grasp that. That's too easy. I understand his grace today. But I couldn't grasp grace because I thought I had to earn it. And I thought I had to be doing something to get it. But I don't have to be. All I have to do is accept it. And that's hard for this alcoholic to accept something good being given to me. That's hard. But today I know what that is. And so that helped me with the third step. And we got down on that. On our hands and knees, and we did, and we took that third step, and we talked about the selfishness and self-centeredness that is the root of my problem. See, I'm my problem, and she, after doing it, she said, "Jan, put a little sticker up on your mirror. You're looking at the problem," and I did that every single day. I made sure that I knew I was the problem. So if I'm the problem, then I have to work on me. But we took that third step. And we got on our hands and knees, and it says, being convinced, we were at step three. See, I had to be convinced that I was ready to do this thing. Being convinced we were at step three, we did this. And we said the third step prayer. And what she read after that was, you know, something happens after taking that third step. And it says, as we felt new power flow in us, this is after taking the third step. As we enjoyed peace of mind, as we discovered we could face life successfully, as we became conscious of his presence, we began to lose our fear of today, tomorrow, or the hereafter. We were reborn. And that's a spiritual rebirth that this big book talks about. And I'm not ashamed of my God today. I'm not. And the big book says we don't have to crawl or be ashamed of our God, that's who we depend on for our sobriety. But I began that spiritual rebirth, and I began to grow in that area. And so, of course, the natural course after the third step was the fourth step. And for the first time in my life, saying there was many, many times that I wanted to run from her because I thought I told her too much and she just didn't love me anymore. And she said, Jen, you got it up here, but you don't have it in here. And it's a long way from your head to your heart. And my heart was something that it took me a long time to learn, that I learned how to open it up. So I did that fourth step, and I got to her house on a Sunday afternoon, and we read that, we talked about it, and I did that fifth step with her. And for the first time, I thought, oh, Lord, when I got through, and I didn't feel that relief that some people said they felt. I just thought, wow, I said too much. I felt raw on the inside, and I thought, oh, I can't come back here tomorrow. But I did go back there the next day, and that helped me to realize to keep going back and to do those things. So after the fifth, she said, you go home for an hour, you take that book down, and you do just what it says in the book, and you make sure that all your stones are in place and that you've put a firm foundation under your feet up to this point. And I did that, and then I did sixth and seventh and said that seventh-step prayer and became entirely ready for God to have, for God to remove my defects of character. Now, some of the things automatically stopped when I got sober. I quit lying, well, and I quit running around, and I started coming home the same day I left. I could tell Tim I'm going to a meeting, and I'll be home at 9 o'clock, and I was home at 9 o'clock. You know, what a concept. That just blew me away. I started becoming responsible a little bit. She said, you know, and there were many times, not many, because I learned real fast, that she says be at her house at 8 o'clock and I'm there at 10 after 8, she's gone. She don't wait around. That taught me to be where I say I'm going to be, do what I say I'm going to do, and be accountable. See, and all my life she taught me accountability. Alcoholics Anonymous teaches me accountability because I have a responsibility to Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I have a responsibility to present Alcoholics Anonymous in a way that other people are attracted to it. And she taught me that, and she didn't mean it egomania. She says, Jan, you may be the only cover of the big book somebody sees. And do what they see in you attract them to this program? And I've always remembered that. And so because I did the sixth and seventh, I had to make that list and I had to make amends now. And I did that, and I made amends to my family, to my father. My father wouldn't even open his door to me because I was angry. I was very angry. So when I found out what his phone number was, he got the brunt end of my anger every time I was drunk. And I would call him up, and I would cuss him out, and I would cuss my stepmother out because, of course, it was all her fault that he did what he did. And I was very ugly to them. And the way I had to make amends to him was that I had to write a letter because I wasn't welcome. He wouldn't open his door when he saw me coming. And I made the financial amends that I had to make to, like, doctors and to bills that I had. I mean, I had to make amends, and making amends is to repair the damage. A simple I'm sorry will not foot the bill. Because they knew I was sorry. I said, I'm sorry all my life. I'm sorry, I'm sorry, I'm sorry. They knew that. To make amends means to repair the damage and then don't damage it anymore. To do something different. And I had to make living amends to my husband and to my family, and something that helped me. My sponsor, I read the chapter to the wives, and I read the family afterwards. I had to read that to learn how to start. And it says, first thing she says, we simply do not stop drinking. Worst thing, I've got this highlighted, as so long as we place dependence upon other people ahead of dependence on God. And something else, it says, burn the idea into the consciousness of every man that he can get well regardless of anyone. The only condition is that he trust in God and clean house. Because what she taught me was that Jan, AA, Alcoholics Anonymous, and Al-Anon brings families together. They don't tear them apart. And I didn't want to lose my family again. Now, Tim didn't stop drinking when I got sober. And he didn't have to because I read this and I thought, this is my problem. My disease is my problem. And I'm not leaving my husband. I don't have to leave my family. I don't have to tear it apart. If I want to stay sober, I can get sober as long as I trust in God, and that's what kept me sober. So those things rocked on, and I did the night step, and a good thing happened. I hadn't saw my father, and I told you how I had to make amends. Well, my grandmother died, his mother, and I thought, I called Louise, I scared death. I said, I'm going to see him. You know, it's like a little kid. I said, what am I going to do? She says, Jan, you're going to go and do the responsible thing and go to your family and be there. I said, but, well, I recognize him. How do I know this program works? That's really what I was afraid of. I was afraid that I was going to still have all that resentment, all that anger. And there was, you know, I said, how do I know it's worked? How do I know this stuff is gone? Because I hadn't had to face him, you know. And she says, you won't know till you see him. So I was standing in the kitchen of my grandmother, of Granny's house. We called her Granny, and he walked in, and I didn't recognize him. He saw me first, and when I finally saw him, he just grabbed me, and he pulled me to him, and tears just streamed down his face, and he says, I sure have missed out on a lot, hadn't I? And I said, yeah, Daddy, but you don't have to anymore. And we were able to build that bridge, to bring that bridge together. And I was invited into his home. And the best privilege that I got was that I got to spend the last 6 months of his life with him. He died about 2 years ago. And the last 6 months was really when all the walls came down, because we didn't have much time. And I know today that he carried his own pain. He carried his pain, and he was ashamed, and he felt guilty. And he had more pain, or just as much pain, as I did. And we were able to be at peace. And he was at peace when he died. And I know that that last 6 months, I hope, was for him, more for me, because I found my peace in Alcoholics Anonymous. And he needed to find his. And God gave me that gift, and I'm so grateful for it. And then I got angry all over again because it wasn't enough time. And then I know that God doesn't make mistakes, and 6 months was just enough time. And the you know, it says that after we make these amends, the promises, after we get to step 9, some of the promises start coming true. And what that did for me was that it restored my relationships with other people, and I didn't have to hide my head in shame anymore. And I could walk, and I could be proud of who I was, because by this time I was liking me, I was loving me, and I was learning how to be okay in my own skin, and I'd never been okay in my own skin before. And so by making those amends and restoring the relationships with other people, again, that helped me get better. And Louise was very, very wise. She would let me know what AA could help me with and what AA could not help me with. And she says, AA is not the answer to all your problems, because I was sick. You know, some of us are sicker than others. She says, that's what the big book says when we have doctors for. And if you need to go to a doctor, then you go. And she pointed me in the directions that I needed to go into. And she kept the singleness of purpose in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I think we need to do that. I don't believe that AA can be everything to everybody. I think it deals with our alcoholism, and that's what we have to focus on. But now I do steps 10, 11, and 12 on a regular basis. I have a step 10 that talks about the selfishness, the resentment, the dishonesties, the fears that continually crop up in my life. And it doesn't say when these things or if these things happen. It says when these things crop up, this is what we do about them. And they crop up in my life. Just because I'm sober doesn't mean that that life don't happen. Life still happens. The only thing about it is different is that I can face life today on life's terms, and that's something I could never do before. That the program of Alcoholics Anonymous has given me tools to live successfully today. And you know, one thing that I know today is that my relationship with the God of my understanding, which step 11, and really all the steps from 3 to 12 is about me getting a better understanding of you and the God of my understanding. And it's to put me in a better relationship with you and him. And I continually seek for God's will in my life, and I ask for it. And some of the amazing things happened when I started seeking. What I found out was that he doesn't make too hard terms. He doesn't demand anything of me. He doesn't give me a whole set of rules that I live by. It's not about that. It's about me just accepting His grace and allowing Him to come in and make a change in my life. That's all He requires. He does the rest if I allow Him to, but I have to be open to that. So I continually seek on a daily basis the knowledge of God's will and the power to carry it out. And today I can honestly tell you that the God of my understanding is my very best friend. He knows me inside and out. He gives me strength when I need it. And today I know that it's His strength that I live on and not my own. And today I know that He always does for me what I can't do for myself. He's just there. He's just there all the time. And nothing can separate me from Him. Nothing. And that was a big deal when I found that out. It was a big deal that I know that I'm not going anywhere, that God lets me know He's not going anywhere, that if anybody moves, it's going to be me. And I have moved occasionally, and I feel the consequences of it when I do. So I seek. And through the 12th step, I got involved in service work early. Like I said, they had me making coffee. They had me answering the intergroup telephones, washing ashtrays, whatever it took. And I'm so grateful. I give in AA, and I do it with a joyful heart. To me, it's just what I need to be doing, and I enjoy doing it. I'm going to close with just to let you know a little bit about my relationship with the God of my understanding, and really what the miracle of His love has done for me in my life. There's a story, and it's in the big book of all big books, and it's about this lady who was caught in adultery. And I don't know how many of you know this story. It's my favorite story. But the town caught her in adultery, and because they have to make examples out of people they catch doing wrong things, they dragged her in the middle of this town, and they were going to stone her to death. They were going to kill her because they caught her. So they had her in this big circle. They were circled around her with these big stones in their hand, and they were getting ready to stone her to death. And all of a sudden, my God walks up behind a circle, and He stoops down and He writes something in the sand. He never says a word. My God don't speak too much. He whispers, and He's very quiet, and so I have to listen for His voice. But He stooped down and He wrote something in the sand without saying a word. I think He wrote something about every person that was in that circle in that sand, something that they thought nobody knew about but them. And then they look down in that sand and they think, oh my goodness, somebody else knows about me besides me, you know. And after He did that, He stood up and He said, the first one without sin cast the first stone. Well, none of them could do it. So little by little, one by one, they had to drop the stones. And they had to turn around and they had to walk away. And here stood this woman, full of shame, full of guilt, full of remorse, full of self-hatred, I'm sure. Full of all the stuff that I had when I came into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, because that woman was me. And had I lived back in those days, I would have been the one being stoned. My God walks up to her after everybody left, and He gently, gently kneels down, and He holds her, and he puts her in His arms, and He says, my child, where have all your accusers gone? They're not here. He says, where have all your accusers gone? And she says, well, they're not here. And He says, neither do I condemn you. Go and sin no more. See, that's what He did for me, and that's what I think He does for every member of Al-Anon and Alcoholics Anonymous. He gently lifts us up in our deepest, deepest despair, and He restores our health, and He restores our emotions, and He restores our families, and He does for us what we could never, ever do for ourselves. I thank you guys for having me here, and I would like to say again thank you to the committee and let you know that I love each and every one of you very much. Thank you.